Support for 30 Days of West Virginia Music is provided by Bunge Jam Music, featuring Todd Burge's most recent studio album, Imitation Life, produced by Tim O'Brien. More information at toddburge.com. Support is also provided by Kinship Goods, proud supporter of DIY music and the arts. Locally shipped worldwide at kinshipgoods.com.
You can do what you like to do if you just find the part of it that will connect with people. You know, you can get help. It's not anything that you can do on your own, and it's smart to ask for a little help and advice, and the people are out there. They're there in the state, and they're outside of the state as well. But I think, you know, young people playing music and trying to make a career, you just have to stick to your guns, and you have to find a way to do it.
I'm Joni Deutsch, and this is 30 Days of West Virginia Music, a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. Throughout the month of June, we are celebrating some of the folks who are making the West Virginia music scene wild and wonderful. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews. And we conclude the second season of our series with a West Virginia music history lesson from a legend of bluegrass and arguably one of the Mountain State's musical figureheads. This is Tim O'Brien. So, can you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
My name's Tim O'Brien, and I'm a musician.
You're much more than a musician, Tim, but I think that's a very good way of starting it. How did you get started in music in West Virginia?
Well, you know, my sister and I were the musical ones. We're the youngest of five in our family. My sister Molly and I would sing in harmony in church. You know, that was kind of uncommon in the Catholic Church. They kind of sing in unison and kind of Gregorian chant, you know. But we were into the British invasion stuff and the folk music stuff. And she started playing piano and I started playing guitar. And we did school shows together and then folk mass and all that kind of thing. And I just, you know, I kept doing it. And so did she.
And tell me about where you were raised in West Virginia at that time.
I'm from Wheeling in the northern panhandle. And, you know, my dad was an attorney, and we lived in a sort of regular old middle-class, leave-it-to-beaver kind of neighborhood, you know. And we're a block and a half from the Catholic church and the Catholic school where we both went to, my sister and I and my brothers went to grade school. And you know, my parents were into the big band era music of their, you know, their youth, and I was into any kind of music, really. I liked it all. When I started showing an interest in it, my parents were good at feeding the fire. They got me some guitar lessons, and they gave us season tickets to the Wheeling Symphony. You know, we got student tickets to the symphony, and we'd go to the summer concert series at the Ogilvy Park up there. And see some of the, you know, there'd be like some jazz. There might be Count Basie or Ray Charles. There might be the New Christy Minstrels or Ferranti and Teicher, all kind of stuff. But it was cool. You know, I got to see live music there. The Jamboree, though, was another one. The Wheeling Jamboree was going on, and you could go on Saturday night and pay $2.50 for the cheap seats. And you could see people like Merle Haggard and Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, Charlie Pride and Jerry Reed. I don't know. It was great stuff. And the occasional bluegrass act, too.
At the time, it sounds like you were listening and enjoying a lot of, I wouldn't say more traditional, but more orchestral and classical and choral. Were there any West Virginia musicians that you were looking up to for inspiration?
Well, my girlfriend when I was 14, you know, my first girlfriend, her father was into the music, and he collected some instruments. He had a nice mandolin and a nice guitar, and one of the guys that he knew was a guy named Roger Bland, and Roger was a great Earl Scruggs style banjo player and guitarist, and he ended up being one of the staff musicians at the Wheeling Jamboree. So he was the guy that all the bluegrassers in Wheeling learned from, really. He was one of the top players. He was a total nut and later took his own life, but he was a wonderful guy to learn from. And, you know, I got inspired to play that stuff. I'd been exposed a little bit to Doc Watson by seeing him on TV, and I got one of his records, and then I met Roger, and I was trying to put this together, and Roger gave me enough pointers to get me started.
At what time did you, would you say that you officially became a professional musician?
Well, I was 19. I went to college for a year, and I realized that I was spending most of my time playing the guitar, and I started playing the fiddle, and I went back the second year, and the band that I had been playing with, a bluegrass band there, they had taken me in. Well, they had hired somebody else over the summer. The wind really went out of my sails. I looked around and said, you know, I don't really want to be here. I just want to play music. So I withdrew from college and went back home. I thought maybe I would learn how to make instruments or something so I could be around musicians more. But I ended up just going full bore and just being a performer. I went out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming to be a ski bum and play in bars. You know, I wanted to get away from West Virginia. This is a funny thing, is I couldn't wait to get away from West Virginia. And as soon as I left, and if I would sing a country song or a bluegrass song, people would say, oh, you're good at that, you're from West Virginia. So it became a calling card. And I was already interested in the music of West Virginia for sure, but it became kind of an important thing commercially. It's ironic, really.
You know, around that time that you were becoming quote-unquote a professional musician, what opportunities were there beyond like a Wheeling Jamboree for you to perform and stay in West Virginia?
Well, the Wheeling Jamboree sort of seemed out of my reach. I was playing in, you know, little community events and things, and, you know, weddings, and I wasn't of age to play in a bar. I had some friends that were playing in rock and roll bands and playing in bars before they were of age. They would have had to have a guardian, I guess, to go in there. But, you know, like I say, it was like school shows, and there wasn't that much to do. I was itching to do it, but I was too young. And my parents were not of the kind that stage parents, you know. I think Brad Paisley, for instance, I think his grandfather and his father, I think they really made it possible for him to play as much as possible. They were kind of into it. My parents were kind of lackadaisical. I don't think they really wanted to promote the idea to me that I could be a professional musician, because I don't think they didn't see that as being a viable way of you know, supporting oneself and living one's life. And over, people like me disprove them. We decide that we're going to do it no matter what, in spite of what everybody says. And that's, you know, that's the thing. I just really had to do this. I just love it. And so I just found ways that I could play for people. It was mostly for free.
I would say that you are part of a select crowd of West Virginian musicians who have been able to achieve a great deal of success, but also be able to win, like, say, a Grammy in the process. Does that validate you being a West Virginia musician, that you've been able to achieve that much and show people that West Virginians are more than the stereotypes that people hear about?
Yeah, I think it really does. It means a lot. The Grammy win is a major endorsement by your peers. And these are people from all over the country. They're professionals, and they're people who are watching these things. And when you win a Grammy, it's not necessarily because you put out the best folk record of that year. It's more like you've been doing your work and people remember your name. I mean, it is a popularity contest, even among your peers. But, you know, they tend to view the quality as well, and that makes me feel like I'm doing something right. And, you know, like you say, being from West Virginia, most of us that make a name as musicians or artists have to leave the state to make headway. And when I was with Hot Rise for a dozen years full-time out in Colorado, we were a Colorado band. So you dig into the bio of the band and you find out that I'm from West Virginia. But I'm proud to be, you know, kind of underlining now with this new record that I am from West Virginia, and that it means a lot to how I play. It affects everything about how I do my job, not only just the music, but just the way I live my life.
Well, I came here from Ireland by way of Baltimore. I rode the train 100 miles, I walked 100 more. smell the smoke pouring off those iron mills.
You've mentioned your new release, and it's actually your 16th solo release. It's titled River Meets the Road. And what's interesting about it is that each of the tracks connect back to your home state of West Virginia. Why did you decide to make a West Virginia record like this?
Well, it's just been sitting there waiting to be done. Joni, it's kind of funny. It's like I came home from a really solid year of touring at the end of October, and it takes me a couple weeks to just sort of let the waters calm. And, you know, I thought this is a time when I will write some songs and maybe I'll be ready to make a new record in the fall. And I wrote a couple songs, and they were both about my family. And I also realized if I hurried up, and when I had those 2 free months at the end of the year, November and December, if I hurried up, I could have something out in the spring. And I just thought, well, geez, I've been thinking about this West Virginia angle, and I started making a list of songs and artists that I was interested in covering, and it got to be a giant list. I also had a bunch of songs that I'd recorded for this download label that my partner Jan and I started. We started a thing called Short Order Sessions. And the very first one was about West Virginia. It was about the chemical spill down in Charleston back 3 years ago that wiped out the water supply for a while. And, you know, I had some Buddy Starcher track. I did a version of John Henry, and that's the prototypical West Virginia folk song. It's the prototypical American folk song. And I thought, you know, maybe I already have this record recorded. But then I started thinking, no, I should make all new tracks, and that's what I did. And it's just a matter of calling the musicians in and getting the lyric sheets ready. And I knew a lot of these songs already, you know, the Bill Withers one and the High Flying Bird by Billy Ed Wheeler and that kind of thing, the Lily Brothers and the Lonesome Pine Fiddler's songs. And it was just a matter of kind of getting the musicians on the same page, which here in Nashville is relatively easy to do. And they knew those songs too. It's, you know, that's what's interesting. You know, they know songs by the Lily Brothers, and of course they know Bill Withers, but they know the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers and Ed and Hammonds too.
You're releasing this on your own label. Do you think that even if some people were to say, like, oh yeah, Bill Withers, West Virginia, do you think that you would have been able to do a West Virginia record on a major label? Or do you think that's something that you had to do it yourself on your own terms?
Oh, I think I would have, if I was on a major label, I would have had to had some very successful records before they'd let me do this. And they wouldn't consider it probably as part of my contract. They would just be an addendum, you know. But I'd made a record of Bob Dylan songs that actually is one of the better selling records I ever made. It's called Red on Blonde, and it got nominated for a Grammy and everything. My record label at the time was Sugar Hill. That's not a major label by any stretch, but even they said, well, yeah, well, you can do this, but it's not going to be part of your contract. This is just an extra thing that you get to do, and we'll let you do it, and we'll pay the bills up to a certain point. So I did it, and then I surprised them that this was actually what's interesting to the audience and what sold. So, and I'm finding that with this record, it's like it seems to be doing a lot better than previous records. It's, I don't know, there's a mystery to the West Virginia, and there's a mystery, the music is venerable, and it's got a legacy that hardcore music fans know about. And so it's kind of interesting that I was just, in a way, I was just doing the easiest thing I could do. And it seems to be working really well.
So I want to take a few moments and dive into some of the tracks off the new release and their West Virginia music histories. So to start off, you cover Grandma's Hands by Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Bill Withers. And some people might not know that he is originally from Slab Fork, West Virginia.
I know, isn't it fantastic? One time I was on Mountain Stage doing a taping for that wonderful radio show, and Julie Adams sang Grandma's Hands. And I said, oh, I love Bill Withers. And she said, oh, yeah, we all love him in West Virginia. And I didn't know he was from there. And one of the great things about this project is to give that to my audience, to show them who's from West Virginia and what it comprises. There's so much great, diverse crowd of musicians that have come out of the state in rock and roll and jazz and R&B. But what I've mostly worked in is the country and bluegrass world. So it's good to sort of underline this connection. And in the last 12 years, I've been serving on the board of the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. In that capacity, I've had a reason to call the inductees up on the phone and say, look, you've won. We're going to induct you, and we want to, you know, you to come down to Charleston to receive your award, and we want to know what we can do to write the bio about you, any interview we might want to. You know, I get to talk to these people. I get to call Jimmy Dickens on the phone. I get to call Connie Smith. And at the induction, the very first year, little Jimmy Dickens and Bill Withers were two of the inductees. And I got to look and see them meet one another, you know. And it turns out Bill, when he was little, before he was a musician, he listened to Jimmy Dickens on the Grand Ole Opry from his family radio in the coal country.
That's adorable. So why did you choose Grandma's Hands and not, say, Lean on Me or Ain't No Sunshine for this record?
I thought it was a good one for banjo. One day I just started playing it on the banjo, and it seemed to be, you know, it made it more of a West Virginia song to me, and it made it more like something that fit in my wheelhouse, I guess. And it's nostalgic. You know, there's not a lot of music from African Americans that's nostalgic, because they're not looking at the past as a great thing in many cases. And yet here's Bill, who's written this wonderful song about his grandma. And it's a very contemporary song too. I mean, this is families break up and the grandparents end up raising a lot of kids these days. And you know, it's both an old-timey song and a really modern one at the same time.
Hey, Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands.
You also cover Few Old Memories by the late, great Hazel Dickens. Can you tell us a little bit about her work as a sort of matriarch of West Virginia bluegrass music?
Hazel Dickens was always held up as one of the real mountain singers. Actually, I got a little taste of her early on. I was just starting to play bluegrass. I mean, starting to play professionally. And I was in a fiddle contest up at Bethany College in Bethany, West Virginia. Ola Bell Reed was there to judge the contest and to play shows. So I got to meet her that weekend too. But the concert that I saw was Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. And I'd heard about them. They were fronting the bluegrass band, which was really unheard of. And Ola Bell's another one, like Hazel, it was kind of political with her songs. Very country people who got politicized when they moved to the city. But yeah, you know, the Hazel and Alice records were really kind of a revelation for my sister and I when we started singing duets and trying to find a place in a kind of body of material. Their stuff was just obvious to us. And we didn't really pick much of it to sing, but we're definitely influenced by it. And this is a real sweet but hard-edged thing at the same time they had. She moved to Baltimore with her brothers for work from the coal country, and Mike Seeger met her brother, who was in the hospital, I think, with black lung up there. Mike was working in the hospital, and he found out that this guy and his sister played a little country music, and so he started looking for him. And Hazel was one of his real inspirations. He loved playing with Hazel, and this was a meeting of real McCoy kind of mountain soul singers with the northern folkies there. And it was a great, I think, a spontaneous combustion when they met. I think it really kind of surged a lot of interest in both their minds, and also when they recorded together, it was great. And Hazel, her partner, Alice Gerard, her singing partner, was Mike Seeger's wife for a long time. So they were kind of all in this little pocket of resurgence of country music.
Just a few old memories slipped into my door. Though I thought I had closed it.
So Another impressive West Virginia tribute off the new release is High Flying Bird, which was originally done by Boone County's Billy Ed Wheeler. Is that Chris Stapleton that I hear on backing vocals for the track?
Yeah, that's definitely Chris Stapleton, man. Nobody sings like that but Chris. He came in and made us sit up straight in our chairs, I'll tell you. We're jumping out of our chairs the way he sang that thing. I met him when he first moved to Nashville from Eastern Kentucky. I think he had been selling cars, and he was writing songs in a used car lot and kind of a notebook in his back pocket, probably writing songs. But he had some great songs, and he was obviously a great singer. I got to play on some of his first demos in Nashville, and we kept in touch over the years. And he sang on an earlier recording of mine as well. This is one of the great things about Nashville is these people, like-minded people that you can just call up on the phone and say, I'd love to get you just to sing on one or two of these songs. And I definitely had him in mind for this one. His dad was a coal miner up in Logan. He said, oh, this is West Virginia music. He said, I know all about that. My dad sang that music. And what's funny about High Flying Bird is I learned that song. I know it when I started researching it later. I know that it was recorded by Jefferson Airplane and maybe some of the other counterculture groups from California. But my sister had a version by Richie Havens. I loved Richie Havens in Woodstock. And at that time when that movie came out, I was like 15 and 16 and really wanting to get the heck away from my parents. I wanted to move as far away and I wanted to see the world and I wanted to join the counterculture and all this stuff. I was playing the guitar and I couldn't wait to get away and grow my hair and all that stuff, you know. And that song kind of signifies that, you know. It kind of goes, there's a high-flying bird way up in the sky. Wonder if she looks down as she goes on by. But look at me, I'm rooted like a tree and I can't get away from here. And it's really ironic to find out later that the song comes from West Virginia. So it signifies my leaving West Virginia, but it also is part of the return.
There's a high flying bird flying way up in the sky.
You've returned to West Virginia a number of times over the years, of course, with the different things you do, but also to perform on Mountain Stage. And you've performed on the program over, 20 times since the show began in 1983. You even guest hosted the show a few years back. And for this record, you cover one of Larry Gross's songs.
Larry sang that song, When the Mist Clears Away, on a Mountain Stage show that I was on. I thought, man, that's a fantastic song. And I think maybe I played mandolin or fiddle on his performance of it. And, you know, he played with a house band. And he doesn't sing much on the show anymore, and it's a shame because he's so good. I kept that song in my pocket. I kept thinking that's a good song, and it would be a good one for a bluegrass band to do if somebody needs a song. And then I realized for this record, this is the time to do it because it really does hit the nail on the head. It's sort of the mood that he spins with the lyric and the music is it really describes West Virginia to me. The sort of downtrodden but hopeful way you have to live your life in West Virginia, you know. And I just think Larry's a wonderful writer and personality, but I was really glad to pay tribute to him because nobody really thinks of him as a musician that's been on Mountain Stage because they don't get to hear him play or sing too much.
What does Mountain Stage mean to you as a West Virginian?
Well, this is an interesting thing about Mountain Stage is it brings a lot of musicians into the state from the out of the state to play for the audience there. And, of course, it's a great calling card for the state in that it's broadcast around the country and, I guess, around the world on the web. And people listen to it religiously. It's got a real honesty about it, like West Virginia has in general. You know, it's kind of reflects the state. It reflects well on the state, but they're always about letting you do your thing the way you want to do it. And it's not scripted. It's not edited very much. They just let you do your thing. And that's really rare these days. And maybe, you know, people move to the mountains in the old days to get away from the their landlords and their kings and all that kind of stuff, and kind of live the life the way they want to live it. Maybe they still can do that in West Virginia today.
So based on your experience and your knowledge of West Virginia's music history, what is at the heart of West Virginia music?
It's hard to say what makes West Virginia music so vibrant, but I think that the audience is there for you, and it nurtures some sort of independence, I think. We're kind of off the track in West Virginia, and anything that anybody has to offer in the arts is really kind of, it's really of value to anybody, I think. There's a crowd that will come forward and just eat it up. They'll just eat it right out of your hand. I think that's a big part of it. I also, you know, obviously the bluegrass music and old-time music is a product of the culture and the history of it, where you had the Scots-Irish people moving to the mountains and mixing with the landscape, and they're also later on mixing with the African-American element that came in when the coal mines were so big and the railroads were being built. And it's a real working-class place, and everybody's kind of on the same page in West Virginia. I think even, you know, the richest guy walking down the street will talk to the guy that's sweeping the street, you know. They know each other. It's a small town. It's a small town atmosphere. You know, I think about that song, John Henry, and how it spread. You know, it's a legend of this guy who beat the steam drill, and it was spread by black and white workers, and that's some of the first times when white people and black people were working alongside one another and living one side another was in those days when the railroads were being built and the tunnels were being dug. And in the coal mines into the 20th century, same kind of thing would happen. And it's, I don't know, West Virginia's, there's a hope, like I say. There's some kind of special mix. And the landscape has something to do with it, I think. There's something in the water, maybe, but the landscape and the just the fact that it's off the track has bred a certain thing.
You have accomplished a ton since you first began as a musician. For anyone that's listening that wants to follow in what you've been able to do, what advice would you be able to give them from one West Virginia musician to another?
Well, I think you have to follow your heart, and you have to work hard, and you need to find an intersection of what it is that drives you with a need from the audience. You know, it's like you can do what you like to do if you just find the part of it that will connect with people. You know, you can get help. It's not anything that you can do on your own, and it's smart to ask for a little help and advice. And the people are out there. They're there in the state, and they're outside of the state as well. But I think, you know, young people playing music and trying to make a career, you just have to stick to your guns, and you have to find a way to do it. I mean, I have a friend, Danny Barnes, who says, if you want to be an artist, get your expenses down really, really low. So maybe living in West Virginia might be a good idea, because, you know, it's cheaper to live there than a lot of places. But I would just, you know, I would follow your heart and work hard and try to find a way through the crowd and way to connect to people.
From the time that you were in West Virginia living here as a kid to now, has your perspective changed? Has your sense of hope changed for the state and its music?
I didn't really ever think about West Virginia being a poor place when I was growing up. And I was kind of shocked. I remember when Lyndon Johnson launched the War on Poverty, and he was talking about Appalachia on Walter Cronkite. This guy would talk about Appalachia and Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. And I remember watching that with my dad, and I said, Dad, it said all of West Virginia is Appalachia and it's all poor. I said, we're not poor, are we? He said, no, we're not poor. But, you know, we were well-to-do. But it's kind of a shock to realize that, you know, you're kind of sheltered. And the TV age kind of started to fix that, I guess. But leaving the state and seeing what's possible in big cities, for instance, for musicians, there's a bigger audience. College town, I guess I could have learned that by going to Morgantown and playing for kids. You need a young audience to play to start out, I think. You know, it's been such a long time since I lived in West Virginia. I left at 19 and now I'm 63. So you do the math, but it's, I lived in Colorado longer than I lived in West Virginia. And now I've lived in Tennessee longer than I've lived in West Virginia, but the state sort of still lives inside me. But it was like sort of getting away. It took getting away to have the right perspective to make this record. And I'm really glad that I'm able to, I don't know, give something back or sort of call attention to West Virginia with the music, because it did start me off, and it's helping me to this day. It never goes away, and I really thank the people that I knew there and still know there that helped me.
The other morning at the sunrise, when the mist is on the hills and all around.
Tim O'Brien's latest release is Where the River Meets the Road, out now and available wherever good music is sold and streamed. 30 Days of West Virginia Music is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. This episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Joni Deutsch. Our associate producer is Nathan Thomas. Our digital promotions come from Josh Saul. Our theme was composed by Matt Jackford and performed by Montana Skies and John Query. You can hear more West Virginia music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Follow us on social media or at A Change of Tune. And for more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/wvmusic and subscribe to our podcast feed. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thank you for listening.